This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We are reviewing A Week on Fire today. Things are heating up everywhere. Delta is turning up the heat on the politics of the pandemic. Governor Baker says no to a state worker mandate for vaccines. He wants to prioritize access.
That strategy of making vaccines available wherever and whenever it suits people has proven to be an effective strategy, and I think that positive incentive approach has worked well for us.
Not the case for the city of Boston. Acting Mayor Kim Janey is going much further.
By the end of the month, all city employees, contractors, and volunteers will be required to verify their vaccination status. We encourage other employers to do the same.
Though still not as far as many of her opponents in the mayor's race want. Meanwhile, a slew of government reports and actions this week. A UN climate report that has the planet burning up. Not literally, well, actually, kind of. And the heat's on in Washington as Congress races to finalize more than $4.5 trillion in two spending packages. Here's Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley speaking to NPR.
What progressives have been clear about since day one is that any vote on the narrow bipartisan infrastructure package must also come with a movement on a massive investment in tandem for workers and families.
We'll start there, so join the conversation. What do you make of the climate report this week or new census numbers that show an increasingly diverse Massachusetts and country? Do you support the Democrats' roll of the dice, linking their major infrastructure reforms to the smaller bipartisan infrastructure deal that the Senate's actually ready to pass? Call us. Join the conversation, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK or tweet us at Radio Boston. With us this week, Charlie Chippio, a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and principal of Chippio Strategies, and Marie Frances Rivera, president of the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center. Charlie, Marie Frances, welcome back to both of you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So in general, we keep it pretty local here on Radio Boston, Charlie and Marie Frances, but sometimes what happens in Washington or elsewhere kind of brings the heat for us here in the Commonwealth. And this felt like one of those weeks, which is why we're starting where we are, from the climate and census reports to the infrastructure deal still boiling in Congress. I'm really looking forward to your reactions. I want to start getting full geek on with infrastructure because there's so much money hanging in the balance there. To be clear, the bipartisan bill passed in the Senate puts $1.2 trillion on the table for roads, bridges, transit, a little bit of climate, other infrastructure in there too. Senator Ed Markey's office says that's about $8 billion for the Commonwealth. Is that a good start? Is that money you're excited about, Marie Frances?
We're very excited. So this federal funding package that, you know, may and likely will come down, in addition to the almost $100 billion of federal funding that has already come down through the CARES Act and through the American Rescue Plan and others, is what we need. We need transformational investments at this time. Our infrastructure is in a state of disrepair. We can see that if we look at our trains, if we look at our roads, our bridges are structurally unsound. So yeah, I'm very excited about this, and we need this to pave the pathway to a just recovery here in Massachusetts.
So Charlie, Marie Frances just used the phrase may and likely, and that's kind of the next place I want to go, right? Because this is all, there's a lot of proceduring and posturing and horse trading and arm twisting left to go to get this in, given the commitment to the other $3.5 trillion.
Yeah, and I hope you're not going to make me pretend that I actually understand it all, because it's pretty mind-boggling.
No, I won't, but I will tell you, and I'm looking at Chris Sitterick through the glass. Earlier this week, I made him explain it to me like five times, right? And yeah. I know this stuff, and I still had to make him explain it to me like five times. So what should we be following as lay people as $4.7 trillion is on the table, Charlie?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think a big issue is going to be, you know, now that the Senate has passed this infrastructure, the smaller of the two bills, you know, whether the House is going to follow up on Speaker Pelosi's pledge to not take it up until the Senate also passes the much larger bill. I think that's really the big, that's going to be, I think, the biggest thing to look for immediately.
So
that's going to really show how this goes.
And so let me just, 800-423-8255, is this confusing to you? You're watching Congress, or maybe you're not because it's confusing to you, but what do you think needs to be on the table around infrastructure for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts? Call us and share your throats. Marie-Frances, I'm going to play two pieces of sound for you still in the zone of may and likely get past. First, Senator Ed Markey with us yesterday.
We know that the planet is dangerously warming. We know there are no emergency rooms for planets. We know we have to put the preventative measures in place. And those are all in the big bill. These two bills are the totality of the response to it, a generational response. And I think we can get it done.
So there he is explaining, for example, the climate measures in the big bill that he thinks are essential and the reason he's not willing to horse trade for the small one. On the other hand, we spoke with former Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis this week as well. And when I asked him about whether he'd support waiting for the larger spending package, here's a part of what he said.
I don't think we have an option here. I don't think we've got any alternative. We've got to move on this. This is a very, very important step forward. Can we get the broader package? Yes, I think we probably can, but it's going to be tougher. But in the meantime, I think it would be a mistake to essentially sacrifice what has been a very impressive bipartisan effort.
These are tough judgment calls, Marie-Frances. Where do you come out?
Well, you know, Senator Markey is closer to the horse trading, and it seems like our congressional delegation, the messages that they're sending down to us, in addition to the intense public pressure around this climate crisis that we're in, is, I feel, going to push both of these packages over the finish line.
So, Charlie, I asked to some extent Senator Markey, I kind of pushed him hard on that yesterday. One of the things that was interesting that he said was we kind of have to hold up the $1.2 trillion because people do want it. It is our effective leverage. It is how he is horse trading. At the same time, as a constituent, right, of all of Congress, I think, okay, so what happens if we get nothing, Charlie? Or am I just foolish? Are we going to get something?
Well, Tiziana, you are certainly not foolish.
Oh, thank you.
I think, I don't think we're going to get nothing. I think the more likely approach is that to get the votes, of the Joe Manchins and the Kristen Sinemas, you know, the more moderate Democrats, and just to back up, you only need 50 votes for the larger bill, because it's going through this, what's called the reconciliation process, because it's a budget bill.
50 votes in the Senate, just to be clear.
Yes, in the Senate, yes. And so I think, I think what's going to happen is that bill is going to shrink. I think, you know, it's just going to have to get somewhat smaller in order to get those votes and bring it to 50. I think that is probably the most likely outcome.
All right. So last question to you, Marie-Frances, because I love the way that you love numbers. In the smaller bipartisan package, that $1.2 trillion, Senator Markey's office says about $8 billion comes to the Commonwealth, $4.2 for roads, $1.1 billion for bridges, $2.5 billion for enhancing public transit. Okay. So if that doesn't come, the MBTA, you mentioned we have some other money from pandemic relief. The MBTA already has $900 million roughly coming. Can we do what we need to do with our roads, our bridges, our public transit if we don't get a bill?
No.
All right, there you have
it. We can't.
And how
we can.
How bad, right? On a scale of we'll limp along to this could be catastrophic, right? How bad is it if we don't get some investment?
We have, I can't remember the number of bridges off the top of my head, but we have a fair number of bridges in our state that are structurally unsound. We know that we need investments in our T and our regional transit systems across the state. And we're relying on major infusions of federal dollars, as we often do, in order to upgrade these systems. There's revenue that we can raise here on the state level, but we really need large infusions of federal dollars in order to do this and do this well, keeping in mind the climate change and climate resiliency that we have to build into these projects.
So also, just according to NBC 10, there are some 500 bridges here that are structurally unsound as of 2018.
Yes.
One of our team just pulled that number for you and me both. Okay, so let's switch now. Charlie, I'll turn to you because I want to talk about the census a little bit. And I'm going to sort of sneak the headline in by playing some sound directly from Massachusetts Secretary of State William Galvin last night announcing the new census numbers. He says they were positive for Massachusetts overall, especially given the challenges in collecting the data last year.
I do believe these numbers. I believe that these people are here. We see it in our crowded streets. When pre-pandemic, we saw it in crowded subway trains. We knew we had the college population that needed to be counted. So all of these things came to fruition. And I think it's extremely good news for Massachusetts.
So growth in the population overall, increasingly population of color, fewer white people in Massachusetts than before, although Massachusetts remains predominantly white, the fastest growth in the city areas of the Commonwealth. This kind of feels like big news, Charlie, or am I just a data geek?
Well, you are a data geek, yes. But this is big news. Yes, it certainly is big news. I mean, I guess I would say I don't think that it's unexpected, largely. I mean, the fact that we're becoming more diverse, certainly, I don't think anybody's surprised by that. I think perhaps it's happening faster than some people might have thought. But, that is the way that the world is changing. I think it's a good thing for Massachusetts. I think the one surprise there is just, again, that change was happening probably faster than some people might have expected. And also just the degree to which the population has risen in Massachusetts. I think that it was probably a little bit more than people expected. But, I think those are both good things.
So, Marie Frances, the fastest national growth was in cities. That was true here, too. Population growth actually slowed. Now, the rate of growth, slowed in two counties in the western part of the state, Berkshire and Franklin, but is growing fastest around Boston, Suffolk County, and on the islands. Do we need to be – no, let me backtrack. I know that we globally have been having conversations about the mass move to cities around the globe for easily a decade now. But is there any core thinking that needs to change here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts as we recognize what these growth patterns are telling us?
Yes, and I want to say a couple of things. One, to your note about you being a data geek.
A data geek.
And just the importance of the census. I think one thing that we don't talk about enough is that the census determines how we're represented. It determines how billions of federal, state, and local dollars are spent. The formulas that determine how much money your community gets for a particular, area is determined on census numbers. So it's critically important that these numbers are accurate. And I'm glad to hear that Secretary Galvin really believes that the numbers are strong. But we know that even with the growth in, diversifying, which basically means that Black and brown communities are growing in numbers, right? Even with that, if we remember back to when the census numbers were collected, we know that there was a lot of fear that was being seeded in communities at that time, especially immigrant communities, mixed status household communities. So, our understanding of it is that there's still undercounting that's happening in communities. But
I would reiterate that. I think that's actually absolutely true. I think it's unfortunate it doesn't begin to capture it, the way the Trump administration handled this last year. But
so let's talk about that for a minute, because we now have the data we have. It's not like we can go back and redo this census. We do know that there were significant problems with it. And I guess I wonder, Charlie, you just reacted to Marie Frances there. We have to build on the numbers we have. Can we build sufficiently confidently as we redistrict, as we make budgeting decisions, et cetera?
Well, yeah, look, I wish I could tell you that I had more faith that whether it be redistricting decisions or budget decisions that, that they were going to be made more on the merits and with less politics. Nonetheless, I don't think that's changed. I mean, thankfully, Massachusetts has not quite been, has not quite been impacted the way the country as a whole has by this incredible polarization. And, we should be thankful for that. But, I think certainly that the numbers that we have and that we're going to have that we're going to use, are certainly going to bring in resources that will be a very good thing for Massachusetts and will help.
1-800-423-8255 to share your reactions to the headlines from this latest census data. Are you surprised about the changes in Massachusetts? What do you expect to happen next as a result? Again, you can join that conversation. So, Marie Frances, earlier this week, we talked about just how hard it is to buy a home in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, where people have to go to find affordability, the fact that even there they may not be able to. I wonder, Jamie Bologna was raising, one of our producers was raising, how does this census data inform or affect what we are seeing in our housing market here in the Commonwealth?
Well, that's a really interesting question. Well, this week we published a report actually on housing and how the state is supporting or not sufficiently supporting the housing crisis that we're in right now. And you might not be surprised to learn that very little state funding is actually going to support home ownership opportunities. It's an extremely small fraction of it. So not answering your question exactly there, but just outlining the problem.
All right. I do want to pick up on one more subject in this section of our conversation, which is the climate report from Monday, because, oh, my goodness. So the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change came out with a fiery report this week. Quote, at 1.5 degrees of warming, ocean levels are projected to rise another 1 to 2 feet this century. That's the New York Times paraphrasing. Washington Post reporting that July was the hottest month ever recorded on Earth. And this report strengthens the tie between extreme weather events and climate. We've always been reticent to do that. Well, what we're seeing in the weather today is related to climate change. But this report says, no, we are seeing a causal relationship between extreme weather events and climate. Charlie, is this a wake-up call, or is this old news and somehow finally making its way through to the public psyche in a new way?
Well, I think it's probably the latter, but I think the important thing is that it you know, if this is able to serve as the wake-up call, you know, then I'll take it. You know, I mean, I was talking to my kids this week, and I said, God, I feel like I can't even look you in the eye. You know, what we're doing to the next generation. I mean, look, this is an incredibly serious problem, and we need to work to address it. And I certainly hope, and I do have some level of optimism that this, you know, this report has really opened some eyes and will sort of make this a higher priority. I have more hope, frankly, for when it comes to state action than national, and the national action is, and the international action is much more important. But, you know, hopefully it will at least make some incremental progress on that front.
So, Marie Frances, on Monday, we spoke with Peter Frumhoff, who's the Director of Science and Policy and the Chief Climate Scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists. It's a nonprofit in Cambridge. He is actually a previous author of a different UN IPCC report, and here he is sharing his reactions.
It's impossible to recognize what it's describing in those kind of sober scientific terms without tearing up, without recognizing that this is a real gut punch. It describes a world that we may well go into if we don't take actions literally today that will be unrecognizable, one that we do not want to provide our children and grandchildren. It is a heartbreaking story.
I almost want to apologize for playing that, because it brings back home again the depth of pain and fear that this report is bringing home for us. I guess my last question on this, Marie Frances, is this strikes me as a problem of collective action at every level.
Yes.
Individual behavior changes all the way to global policy changes. How do we get a foothold now on change?
We know what the solutions are. There are proposals for Green New Investments, Green New Deal investments on the local level, on the state level. On the federal level, we need to hold our leaders accountable to implementing the solutions today. There are no shortage of solutions and proposals to address this. We need the investments to back it up, and we need other policy solutions, ordinances, whatever they may be, that really have some teeth to also hold corporations accountable to being good neighbors.
Okay, Marie.
To save our planet.
Okay, Marie Frances Rivera, Charlie Chipio, stay with us, folks. As we go to the break, I'm going to note the latest out of the FDA. Another surprise, or maybe not a surprise, they're authorizing an additional shot of mRNA vaccine for those who are immunocompromised. That Delta variant heats things up at the intersection of COVID policy and politics. That's what we're going to talk about after the break. We will take your calls on that, 800-423-8255. I'm Tiziana Dearing, and this is Radio Boston's Week in Review. Welcome back to Radio Boston's Week in Review. I am Tiziana Dearing. With us this week, Marie Frances Rivera, president of the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center, and Charlie Chipio, a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute. And we are going to talk about the intersection of COVID policy and politics, swift movement towards masking indoors, vaccine mandates by many employers. Have you changed your view on anything from last week to this week, or from 2 weeks ago to this week? Do you approve of Acting Mayor Kim Janey's decision to require vaccines for Boston City workers? Or do you prefer Governor Charlie Baker's carrot approach to vaccinations? Boosters now on the table for the immunocompromised. What are your reactions to that? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. Okay, Charlie, let's start with one of the questions I just asked the listeners. Has anything on your mind changed about COVID policy in any way over the last couple of weeks? I wonder if Delta has you thinking differently at all.
You know, I have to say the answer to that is yes. What's happened with me is that I think that, and I think this really is a very, this is not a, you know, a very rational thing in a way, but, you know, it's, I have become increasingly angry simply because of the fact that I believe that, you know, look, the Delta variant is what it is. But the fact of the matter is, you know, I was just looking at some numbers from Mississippi. You know, 97% of the people who are in the hospital in Mississippi are not vaccinated. And the fact of the matter is that the Delta variant would have an impact no matter what. But if everyone were vaccinated, this impact and what we are going through right now would be far less severe. And I'm just plain angry because this is so avoidable. We just shouldn't have to go through this anymore. Selfishly, I'm tired of the masks. I'm tired of now, you know, when I go into Boston a day or two a week, you know, I'm walking around and having it be a ghost town. It's depressing. It doesn't need to be that way. And frankly, the impact it's had on me is that it's made me much more open to more aggressive moves, you know, to make sure that people are vaccinated.
Marie Frances, are you angry?
I think as many people, I'm tired, I'm frustrated, I'm sad at the situation that's going on. And I feel like we, as Americans, are very individualistic in our thinking, and it's critically important that we remember that we live in a community. So if you're unvaccinated and happen to end up in the hospital for COVID-19, you're taking up a bed. I heard a doctor recently talk about you're taking up a bed that somebody who may be in a car accident might need. So it's just extremely selfish, and it's quite easy to get vaccinated. So yes, I am. I'm with everybody on. I'm being upset and frustrated, and it's been a long pandemic.
So I'm going to play a couple of pieces of sound here. And I did not set the two of you up by asking you if you're angry first, but I want to riff on what you're saying. So I'm going to play two pieces of sound from a conversation we had earlier this week with people working on mobile vaccine access. First, we heard from Dr. John Broach, an emergency physician and organizer of a mobile vaccine clinic for UMass Memorial Healthcare. He told us about some unconventional methods they're using for getting shots in arms.
Knocking on doors, standing on street corners, flagging down cars, asking them to pull over and give us a few minutes of their time to talk about the vaccine, and then have the vaccine right there ready to administer.
And to clarify, I said, wait a minute, you actually flag down cars? And he said, yes, we do. All right, so then here is Lawrence Mayor's Kendris Vasquez on that city's work to increase vaccination rates.
The accessibility is critical. In a city like Lawrence, you do understand a lot of our folks, they have two jobs, and you know, it might become inconvenient for you to actually set yourself some time to go get the vaccine because you have to get from one place to another relatively quickly. So bringing it to them is critical.
I remember thinking at the time, Charlie, that I was surprised how much they were emphasizing that access actually still remains an issue. And they talked about the importance of catching people where they are with a health professional who can answer their questions on the spot and then literally stick a shot in the arm right there. Are we needing to make a massive rehaul of our vaccine distribution strategy so that everybody can be able to take their masks off again?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm gonna be honest with you. I wish I knew the specifics well enough to know the answer to that. In other words, I don't fully have a grasp on what percentage it is those folks who are trying to work two or three jobs and just trying to fit it in, and we just need to accommodate their needs and the degree to which it's people who are simply refusing to take it. But I certainly have no doubt that we need to, you know, God bless those people who are waving over the, you know, waving down the cars and doing that kind of thing, because, that's the kind of thing that we need to do, to make all of our lives better, not to mention theirs.
All right. So then let's pick up on what we do at the public policy level. And one of the things that's been interesting is to watch acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey this week decide, after pushing back, it sounded like, on the issue of various kinds of vaccine mandates last week, deciding to require either mandates or regular testing for the city's employees. That's roughly 18,000 people. And then Governor Baker basically saying, no, I want to use a carrot approach here. I want to work on access. People in Massachusetts make good decisions. If we keep the access up, they will get shots in arms. And when they get a first shot, they usually get a second shot. Marie Francis, which one do you advocate?
So we can't politicize this issue. There are other vaccines that we've mandated and continue to mandate for young people, for students. So this is no different. Part of it is, to go back to your earlier point about reaching people in communities where they're at, it's partially about also investing in the public health infrastructure in order to reach people. But I believe that mask requirements and vaccine requirements make sense at this time in the middle of this pandemic that is raging in our state.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. 1, are you angry? 2, are you tired? 3, what do you think our state and city public policies need to be now? Join this conversation. So, Charlie, one of the things that was interesting to me, so acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey comes out and says, let's do a vaccine or testing mandate for city employees. She is in a mayor's race, and it is one of the biggest cities in the state. Some came to the left of her, some of the other candidates, saying that is not enough. And then we had other candidates who, like Boston City Councilor Anissa Sibey-George, who was on yesterday, saying, I wouldn't go quite that far. Here's what she said about the Boston vaccine mandate for city workers.
The most important thing for us to be focused on as a city, whether it's for our city's employees, our city's residents, is to make sure that they have access to vaccination. We have to continue to work on that. I don't agree with mandating vaccination. I think it's important to encourage it and to make sure that testing is available.
So you could hear me start to ask her another question there in the middle of that. That's what that was. Charlie, what strikes me about that, this is a progressive slate of candidates. They are the most diverse slate of candidates in the history of the city. And those 5 candidates don't agree on what's right. So are we at a time when policy uncertainty is appropriate, or do we need to coalesce somewhere? Do you understand what I'm asking you?
Yeah, I mean, I do. Look, I think I do take some hope in the fact that the most recent numbers are showing that with this spike, the number of people who are getting vaccinated is going up again. I think there's probably a little room here around the edges in terms of if indeed those numbers are going up, if indeed they continue to go up. And so it shows that the current approach is working, then I'm okay with that. I have very little patience, though. I have a very limited amount of time that I'm willing to wait if those things don't go up and continue going up before this thing completely gets out of hand.
So, Marie Frances, I want to shift to boosters for a minute. Over the weeks on our Ask the Doctor segments, which we usually do on Tuesdays, we've asked lots of different questions about boosters. It was really interesting. This Tuesday during our regular Ask the Doctor segment, we heard from Dr. Shira Durone, who we have on a lot, infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. We asked her her take on booster shots, and although she doesn't like to call a third dose for the immunocompromised folks a booster, here's what she said about a third shot for the general population, and this was earlier this week.
I have not seen any convincing evidence to say that we need them yet or that we'll need them soon. That decision should not be based on antibody levels. That decision should be based on whether we're seeing severe disease in people who are vaccinated.
So recognizing that booster is maybe a cheap shortcut way to describe this. Of course, later the FDA says for this week, yesterday, for immunocompromised folks, they will authorize an mRNA additional shot. It is interesting to have someone like Dr. Durone say, but we aren't seeing people be hospitalized. We aren't seeing them get severe levels of illness. From that perspective, the vaccine works. But public impatience for boosters is massive. What's your reaction to all of that?
I am very fortunate. I feel very fortunate that we have public health experts that are debating these things, because COVID-19 is a fairly new phenomenon. We're all trying to figure it out as we go. And I think the suggestion around getting the booster shot for a very small percentage of Americans who are immunocompromised seems to make sense. Again, if we are going to go through a round of booster shots, it's thinking about what is the infrastructure that we have in place, and have we funded it properly in order to make sure that we have it in place for, you know, everybody who needs it?
Let's grab a couple.
Those hardest to reach.
Let's grab a couple calls here. 800-423-8255. We've got Lisa on the line in Peabody. Lisa, go ahead.
Hi, Tiziana. Thanks for having me. I really, like, I'm not angry, because I try to be understanding of people that it's considering the fact that it's still an emergency use, so we know that the CDC is working expeditiously to approve that, like the FDA. But here's another thing. Like, when you have to put your kid in high school, it's mandated to do, like, a physical. Otherwise, your kid doesn't get into high school. So two works or not, even if you work two or three jobs, you find time to do it. So, like, the entire country gave vaccines, made it accessible, something that we thought it wouldn't happen. They made it, like, very accessible to everyone, and people just choosing not to take. So some people just for political reasons, and that pisses me off. Not the fact that you have questions about it, but the other one, yes, it really does.
The one where you just choose not to. Thanks for that call, Lisa. Let's pick up Danny in Cambridge as well. Danny, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm an emergency doctor, and I also studied public health at the New York City Department of Health in Columbia for 2 years. So I'm kind of an expert, but my public health expertise is a little bit outdated. So I have a question. Historically, this country has protected people from those who did not take precautions. For example, people with tuberculosis could be isolated against their will. Everyone knows the story of Typhoid Mary. Students are regularly not allowed to go to school if they're not vaccinated. As I said, I have a history of expertise in this area, but I'm really not up to date on the law. And my question is, does anyone know what is going wrong with the law? Why is this a debate? This virus is mutating, and Delta's bad, and the next one could be worse. I just don't understand why there is a debate and why everyone is not vaccinated, whether they want
to. Okay. Thank you, Danny. I appreciate that. And I want to refer everybody back, and maybe we can bring the link back on this. We actually did, earlier in the pandemic, we did a segment on the history of pandemic law, where we learned a ton about the history of lots of local precedents, usually local boards of health, creating law and public policy around pandemics, vaccination, required medication, etc. It would be an interesting one to go back to. Marie Frances, what's your reaction to what we were just hearing from Danny?
Essentially what I'm hearing both of your callers saying is that we have mandated or required vaccinations or public health measures currently and in the past. And I'm just completely in line with that. With the surge in cases, it makes a lot of sense to continue something we've traditionally done as a nation, as a state, as localities, is to mandate public health measures that make sense.
So, Charlie,
backed by evidence.
Charlie, I'm sorry to interrupt you there, Marie Frances. Charlie, I also want to come back to schools here, also thinking back, right, to 18 months of covering the pandemic. And I remember there was a time when it felt like everything we were talking about at this pandemic had to do with schools, had to do with kids, keeping them safe. And it feels like deja vu all over again. Whether, you know, Charlie Baker wants local municipalities to make masking mandates if they want them. More and more districts are. More and more fights over whether or not to mask. Lots of concern among parents for kids going to school who are too young to get vaccinated. And worries about whether or not we might see schools shut down again, despite what seems to be a collective wisdom that we can't afford to do that. Do you I kind of feel like there's a train wreck coming, Charlie.
Well, look, I think that is unfortunately a very reasonable concern. I mean, if you just look at what we see in terms of the numbers, in terms of learning and what went on in the last year. I mean, look, it's going to take years for those students to recover from last year. We have a replay of that again. That is really going to be a devastating thing. You know, we also did a few months ago, we did a poll at Pioneer. We commissioned a poll on this kind of stuff. And I got to tell you, parents are not happy. They are really angry. And that is just really something that we have got to avoid. You know, that's why I think that's one of the main reasons, frankly, that I think that I'm getting increasingly comfortable with more, more aggressive moves to ensure the vaccine. And look, I don't want to try to underplay the whole mask issue and all that kind of stuff. But I really think the vaccine is the ball game at this point. I mean, that's really the important issue, the most important issue.
Okay, on that note, I am going to turn us now to our hubbubs. It's time for those local stories or events that caught our attention this week. Marie Frances, what'd you bring us?
So I'd like to spotlight an article that just came out in the Globe on a spotlight of Catherine Morris. She's a cultural leader in the arts community in Boston. She's going to be starting a new role as Director of Arts and Culture at the Boston Foundation, but founded BAMS, a Boston Art and Music and Soul Festival. So there's an article in the Globe that highlights her leadership. I encourage people to check it out.
All right, a shout out there. Charlie, mm-hmm. I think you have a sort of shout out of your own, yeah?
Yeah, I tell you, I was just really touched by this horrible story of this 8-year-old boy, Danny Sheehan, in Marshfield, who died after, a 4.5-year battle with brain cancer. And it's just horrifying as that is. I was just so touched and so impressed with the way the town of Marshfield and people around him, sort of rallied around him and that family. You know, they had made him an honorary Marshfield police officer a couple of years ago. He loves superheroes and in particular Aquaman. Mm-hmm. And you know, when he died, which was just early Sunday morning, after that, they had a procession. People in Marshfield just lined the streets. They did a superhero procession to honor him. Police cruisers, motorcycles from Marshfield, from surrounding towns. It's just the kind of thing that says to me that, you know, as that boy's family goes through this horror, I feel like at least they're going to get the kind of support that they need and that they deserve, because this town has really proved that it's there for them. And that's if there is any silver lining in this horrible thing, I think that is it.
Well, Charlie, thanks too for giving us and our listeners a chance to send our own good thoughts and heart to Danny, to his family, to the town of Marshfield. I love it when we have a chance, even in grief, to stand in solidarity with each other. So thank you for bringing us that hubbub. I'm going to do something a little different for my hubbub. I did have one, but we have an 11-year-old who called on the break wanting to talk about climate, and she waited this whole time to get her voice on our air. So I am going to turn my hubbub over to Fiona, who is driving in Boston. Fiona, hi.
Hi.
Go ahead and share your thoughts.
Okay. Well, I'm 11, and even though it's not going to be a very long time, it's going to be a very long time until I have children. It was 100 degrees as I drove near Boston today, and I realized that we're going to leave, like, my generation is not going to have a good life in this world, and we need to do something about climate change if my children are going to have a life. And when I was really, really little, I went to, my mom organized this, event at the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. And it was called Moms Clean Air Force. And my mom and, lots of other people around the country were trying to make it so that my generation could have a chance at living in this world, like, we were supposed to.
And Fiona, excuse me for interrupting you. Is your mom in the car with you now?
Yes, my mom is.
Okay. I'm sure she's really proud of you for this, and I'm proud of you for calling and sharing your thoughts with us. I'm going to thank you for calling, and I wish you and your mom a safe drive. And, you know, from the mouths of babes. That's why we do this, is what we're talking about. So on that, I'm going to end. But Fiona, thank you. Let me let you say goodbye to everybody, too.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Great to have you. And I'm also going to say goodbye to Marie Frances Rivera, president of the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center, and Charlie Chipio, a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and principal of Chipio Strategies. Marie Frances, Charlie, thanks for doing Week in Review with us.
Thank you for having me on. Thank you. This was great.
Stay tuned. There's more ahead. This is Radio Boston.